This is audiobook of the title, The Mediumship of Jack Webber, by Harry Edwards. Jack Webber passed into spirit life, after a very short illness, on March 9, 1940, aged 33 years. The manuscript of this book was in the publisher's hands in January, 1940, as the book had been written while Jack Webber was still with us, and a long life of service contemplated. It has been emphasized in the foreword and conclusions that as the mediumship was contemporary, every statement made regarding the phenomena was capable of being re-demonstrated under test conditions before impartial authorities. That position has now, unfortunately, been altered. In consultation with the publishers, it was, nevertheless, decided to publish the work as originally written, with the addition of this explanation. In order to include the 1,940 photographs, and in order to make the record complete, addenda have been added to various chapters. For the interest of readers, it may be added that at no time was any weakening of the mediumship noticeable. The number of occasions on which Mr. Webber demonstrated was strictly limited and the rules were never exceeded. The guides were frequently consulted as to the medium's physical condition, and no anxiety or hint of weakening was disclosed. Mr. Webber enjoyed a strong constitution and had not had a day's illness since he was 14 years of age, until this year. Therefore, there is no known reason to assume that his passing was in any way connected with his mediumship. 9. It was only 12 days before the passing that the remarkable photograph, plate number 7, was obtained. And during the week previous to his passing he gave two very fine seances to the spiritualist community in London. While the loss of the mediumship to the spiritualist movement is great, the personal loss has been much alleviated by our knowledge of the reality of survival, the evidence already received of his return, see chapter 22, and the many tributes to his mediumship and uplifting letters received. His work amongst us is finished, his new work has commenced. Harry Edwards, March 30, 1940. Chapter 1, Foreword. This book presents a series of photographs of supernormal activity and a narrative of events incidental to them. They have been secured through the physical mediumship of Mr. Jack Webber during the 14 months from November, 1938, to December, 1939. They are not ancient history, they are contemporary and are being repeated many times a year, now. If the photographs or any statements made are challenged, it is of the utmost importance to remember that the mediumship is still functioning and demonstrations are being continually given. 1. No special set stage is necessary. Mr. Webber gives between 150 and 200 demonstrations a year, by far the greater number in places to which he is a complete stranger. As a rule, he journeys unaccompanied, so that pre-arrangement or confederacy is out of the question. In 1939, over 4,000 persons witnessed the phenomena, from small home circles to mass seances of 500 people. The photographs have been taken in different places, sometimes in surroundings that the medium has never before visited. Quite often he has arrived only a few minutes before the commencement of the sitting. The photographers have been official press photographers representing national newspapers who have provided their own cameras and plates and undertaken all process work in their own studios. Other persons who have taken photographs have only been present through their possessing a suitable camera. The sitters who have been present during the period under review represent many professions, including official representatives of the British Broadcasting Corporation, national newspapers, the editors of the Psychic News, the Two Worlds, Light, and the USA Journal of Psychical Research, admirals of the fleet, clergymen, doctors, scientists, university officials, etc. While psychical research societies in London and the provinces have tested the mediumship over and over again, a skeptical mind has to face the fact that the photographs and reports are true. Otherwise, there must have been a gigantic conspiracy embracing many hundreds of people, including organizations and newspapers of note, all actively participating in fraudulent acts to deceive the public without motive or reward. Newspapers and their critical representatives are only too willing to expose fraudulent mediums, yet all, without exception, have testified to the mediumship under review. No critic, worthy of the name, would classify all the alert, questioning minds that have testified to the mediumship of Jack Weather as dupes or simpletons. To produce faked photographs, as perfect as those reproduced, would include a number of the most reputable photographic firms in the conspiracy, also the technical staffs of the newspapers whose names are printed in the reports. Actually, the question of faking negatives cannot arise since the phenomena are visible to all present when the exposure flash is made. Finally, a hostile mind has to take into account the scores of reports published in the psychic and general press by correspondents of unimpeachable integrity, who have voluntarily supplied appreciative commentaries on the mediumship. Numbers of these reports are included with names and dates of publication. Three independent accounts of seances are published, two by official representatives of our national daily newspapers, reprinted word for word, and the other from the pen of one well-versed in psychic research. These give a good impression of the happenings at a typical seance. The purpose of this book is to add a little to the known proven knowledge of the powers of the spirit people manifesting through a human medium. Phenomena occur when the medium deliberately sits for their manifestation in a state of deep trance and with his normal consciousness dormant. In this state of acquiescent dormancy, the right physical and mental condition for the operation of psychic powers is attained. Thus, an invitation is extended for the manifestations. Every movement of matter, every vibration and radiation, even life itself, are subject to definite forces controlled by law. The simple action of lifting an object into the air, and returning it to the place from whence it came, brings into action a controlling mind force. To carry out a similar action by psychic force denotes the presence of an intelligence possessing the knowledge of applying psychic forces to a physical object. For intricate and involved operations, of which the photographs in this volume are corroborative evidence, the controlling intelligence must possess an extensive knowledge of both physical and metaphysical forces and the laws that control them. Since no human mind is capable of manipulating, under seance or any other conditions, a medium's mind or body to produce the phenomena described, it is logical to infer that the controlling intelligence is non-human. Such happenings cannot be the product of the medium's subconscious mind, for there has been no human experience from which a subconscious mind can draw such knowledge. Therefore, if the performance of the many acts chronicled are completely outside man's comprehension, the salient fact emerges there is no alternative that the operating intelligence must belong to a discarnate entity, and that, therefore, spirit people do exist. Realizing this, there is no reason why we should not accept the statements of the spirit controls that they once lived on the earth. Unquestionable evidence is further provided by the spirit people themselves who return to their relatives in a recognizable materialized form and speak in their own voice and language of intimate mutual earth experiences. Since this is so, it is indisputable that our relatives and friends must still be living to be able to communicate so. If this book establishes this position, its purpose will be achieved. The value to humanity of proving beyond all doubt the truth of survival is incalculable. With the recognition that this life is but a prelude to a further and more enlightened existence, the nature of which is individual and therefore dependent upon our conduct here, so must a transformation in our present code of values take place. In this calculating and questioning age, a firm, demonstrable foundation is necessary for an enlightened philosophy of life. Never before has there been a greater need for such a philosophy than during these days of war, and the need will be even greater in the days of reconstruction after the war. All peoples will then be seeking a new morality, based upon stronger claims than traditional credulism. Now on 14. The structure of our present civilization is based upon laws determined by individual and sectional interests, pregnant with injustices, begetting wars, revolutions, and human suffering. In the past, peace efforts have been conducted by strong sectional interests, with failure as a natural result. Peace and brotherhood, to be real, must be based upon an insistent spiritual force, founded on knowledge, recognizing the true perception of life and its purpose. As prejudice recedes and the general acceptance of the implications of survival advances, so must our civilization conform more and more to spiritual values, impelling the reconstruction of our social, economic, national, and international codes. Developing life on the understanding that human effort should contribute to the peaceful, harmonious, and spiritual progress of humanity. In other words, the aim must be to spiritualize the world. Thanks beyond expression are due to Mr. Weber for his willing cooperation in the work, and particularly so to his spirit guides and workers for their great patience and understanding. Sometimes weeks of work on their part has been destroyed by our clumsiness, yet they have never complained. It is only when one continuously works with these spirit people that one realizes their infinity of resource, and they become as personal as the closest of friends. No form of words can adequately express the thanks that are due to these wonderful people. A tribute must be paid to Mr. Leon Isaacs, for his work in applying infrared rays to the photographing of phenomena, and the help afforded by his perfection of a practical infrared light unit. Thanks are also due to Mr. Maurice Barbane, editor of the Psychic News, for assistance given on a number of occasions, and to the Psychic News, the Two Worlds, the Daily Mirror, and the Sunday Pictorial, for the inclusion of articles and extracts taken from these journals. Chapter 2, The Medium, John Bowden, Jack Weber. Jack Weber was born of Devonshire parents at Lough, South Wales, in 1907. His childhood was as ordinary as that of most children, although perhaps a little more irresponsible than usual. His education was neglected during the war years in the absence of disciplinary insistence upon attendance, etc. At the age of 14 he commenced work in a coal mine, and continued so working until 1936. During the latter period Mr. Weber would be employed underground during the day, arriving home in the evening. He would then prepare himself to sit for physical phenomena. This dual strain on his physical resources was too great to continue, so the manual labor was given up. In early manhood he was a cornet player in the Salvation Army band, his mother being a trenchant Salvation Army worker, whilst his father was a bell ringer in the local Protestant church. When Mr. Weber was about 21 years of age he met Miss Rhoda Bartlett, whom he married in 1930. They have two sons, Denzel, aged 8, and George, aged 6. Mrs. Weber belonged to a staunch spiritualist family which, at the time when Mr. Weber first met his future wife, were holding home circles for the development of their psychic gifts. Thankful appreciation should here be mentioned of the patience and faithfulness of Mrs. Weber and Mr. and Mrs. Evans, Mr. Weber's father and mother-in-law, for their painstaking work in developing Mr. Weber, and their daughter Winnie, now Mrs. Rook, also a well-known healer, speaker, and clairvoyant. 17. To Mr. Weber, at the age of 21, spiritualism was, to use his own expression, bunk. Nevertheless, mainly in order to be with his fiancée, he attended the home circle, and was thoroughly bored with the whole procedure, invariably going to sleep. At this period the circle sat for table phenomena, and, as is customary at such circles, messages would be tapped out. One evening Mr. Weber, still a skeptic, tried to play a joke and manipulate the table to give a false message. To his surprise a message was tapped out, in spite of his mental and physical obstructive tactics. A message which, more amazing still, told of the correct place in which a lost handbag, containing money, would be found. This incident caused Mr. Weber to reconsider his former opinion of the gatherings, and he began to take a more sympathetic interest in the circles he attended. Later on, through his guide, information was given for the finding of the body of a man who had been missing for some days, mention being made of the actual spot by a bridge over a nearby river. On another occasion he told a friend of the passing of a workmate. They had been working together that afternoon and had parted in good health. His friend ridiculed the idea, but afterwards it was found to be perfectly true, as the man in question had passed over at his tea table during that same afternoon. The table circle was changed into a circle for the development of control work, and after about 2 years from the commencement Mr. Weber would sink into a trance-like sleep. The next stage in the development of the medium was the control of the mind and body by spirit entities, the latter being replaced later by the controls using Mr. Weber for his present-day work. This development was by no means easy, many tense moments being provided by the violence with which the controls manifested through the medium's body. 18. The spirit guide in control of the medium during seances is Black Cloud. In the early days he asked for toys, musical instruments, etc., to be placed near to Mr. Weber in the circle. Trumpets, too, were soon added. First of all, slight movements and rappings were noted. Then development came quickly and levitation of the trumpets and objects followed soon after. It was suggested that Mr. Weber should sit in a cabinet. But, to Mr. Weber's normal mind, to sit in an enclosed cabinet was sufficient to induce a certain amount of suspicion. Mr. Weber has never used a cabinet. He prefers to be in the circle, as one of the sitters. Ropes were used to secure him to his chair in the first instance. And it is in this way that the mediumship has been built up, providing a technique the spirit controls are accustomed to. Researchers and others have often suggested other forms of securing the medium, including straight jackets, sewing up in a sack, enclosing in a packing case, etc. Such suggestions have been resisted, mainly because they would be a departure from the technique to which the controls are accustomed. Secondly, because the medium should be protected from fanciful experiments that bleed him, and finally because the use of a red light combined with the precautions stated in the following chapter are ample and sufficient. Even during this stage of his development, Mr. Weber was still skeptical as to the powers being exercised through him, and it was only after visiting other circles in the district, when the same phenomena occurred, and were testified to by independent sitters, that Mr. Weber came to accept as actual fact his own psychic powers. Very strong healing forces soon became evident, mainly through a spirit control known as Malada, a young Egyptian. Considerable healing work was undertaken, including the gathering of herbs and the making of medicines therefrom. Mr. Weber relates how he would be taken out into the marshlands and open country near his home, in a semi-dazed condition, to where the particular herbs grew, collecting them, and then returning home and brewing them for a special complaint. It was found that the healing work exhausted the physical body, so with the development of the physical mediumship the healing work was allowed to lapse. Addendum. May, 1940. Early in 1940, Mr. Stanley Croft, a member of the developing circle, arrived one evening, deeply distressed. His daughter, evacuated in the West Country, had been admitted to hospital with severe blood poisoning, and her life was despaired of. Assistance was asked for through Mr. Weber's healing guides, which they said they would give. Later, during the same seance, the healing control, Malada, spoke through the trumpet and said that he had been to the patient, and that he would again return and draw the poison from her body. He also gave this evidential information: the poisoning had been caused through the sting of an insect in the head. Up to this time, the cause of the poisoning had not been traced, and the medical authorities had no knowledge of the cause of the trouble. Mr. Croft wrote and inquired whether such a sting could be traced. It was then recalled that a day or so before the illness, a bee had become enmeshed in Miss Croft's hair and had stung her when it was being extricated. Neither Miss Croft nor her mother had associated the sting of the bee with the illness, and this evidential information proves the powers of diagnosis, and which, of course, could not possibly have been telepathy. In a few days, all traces of the poison left the patient and the recovery was complete. 20. Most remarkable was the manner in which healing oils would be produced from the medium's hands. Mr. Weber would stand by his patient in an entranced state and thick oil would ooze onto his hands. So thick were these oils that his hands presented the appearance of having been immersed in a large can of Vaseline. The patient would then be massaged with the oil. The preparation of the medium for the work ahead was not restricted to the developing circles. It continued at night time, when loud knocks would be heard, the bed clothes would be pulled off the bed, a bedside table on which stood a paraffin lamp and other odds and ends would tip over sideways and descend to the floor without any oil being spilled or an object displaced, and then be righted again. Voices would be heard, and often Mr. Weber would forcefully express himself, telling the controls to leave him alone. Gradually, as the years passed by, the powers developed, voices in the trumpets, and independent of the trumpet, became stronger. Heads and hands materialized, and eventually the medium was prevailed upon to give demonstrations before strangers, visiting on a friendly basis the homes of neighboring spiritualists. Until quite recently, Mr. Weber was afraid of these phenomena. Generally, as soon as he sat for a seance and the light was extinguished, and before Mr. Weber went into a trance, there would be noises and the levitation of trumpets, etc. These made the medium fearful until the trance state took away his consciousness. However, this fear is now disappearing, for in the developing circle, in red light, voice and levitation have been manifested before normality departs. At first these phenomena were of a few seconds duration, and then week by week they became gradually prolonged to from 5 to 10 minutes. Consequently, the medium can now see a part of the phenomena, and is able to hear and speak to his own controls. 21. Mr. Weber is an unassuming man, unlettered, fond of athletic sports, a keen dart player, and always willing to help anyone in need of his assistance. Never yet has any person been denied who needed the comfort of the return of their loved ones, even if they were unable to pay as much as a portion of the usual fee. Mr. Weber has cooperated with cheerful willingness in all efforts to further our knowledge of the spirit people. The following are some of the main spirit controls concerned in the present-day mediumship. Black Cloud, a North American Indian of the Mohawk tribe. He takes charge of the seance and is in direct control of the medium's body. When Black Cloud first made his presence known, he could not speak English, and left for a time to learn, through the medium, an English vocabulary. It is to Black Cloud that we are most indebted, both for his cooperation in taking photographs and also for the considerate understanding which he has shown and which has endeared him to those who have had the privilege of cooperating in the work. Paddy, a boy control. He is one of the most active workers in the seance, and is in control of the inner circle. He acts as instructor to the spirit people who desire to make their presence known, telling them the way to use the ectoplasmic voice mechanism. He is an exceedingly humorous turn of mind, but can be very serious, especially when giving an explanation as to how the phenomena are produced. Paddy sings in a thin voice and has materialized many times. He is a constant visitor to the homes of members of the developing circle, recounting various incidents that have happened to them during the day. A most lovable personality. Reuben, a South American schoolmaster by profession, visited this country during his earthly life and passed over from tetanus. In his early attempts to control the medium was very violent, reproducing the physical contortions of the disease from which he passed over. He is a powerful agency in the circle work, and is particularly noted for his strong singing voice, a rich baritone, which has been recorded by the Decca Record Co. Limited. This voice is so powerful as to be of full loudspeaker strength, and is referred to in a later chapter. Reuben also controls the medium for trance addresses on the platform, but this work has been allowed to lapse in order to conserve the medium's strength. He was fully materialized. Other controls are Malida, the healer, Talga, Reverend John Bowden, a great uncle of the medium, Dr. Miller and Professor Dale, whose work is mainly concerned with the materializations and whose earthly existences have been verified from the data they have supplied. Chapter 3, Infrared Photography. The following is a simple non-technical description of the method whereby the photographs reproduced in this book have been secured. All the photographs have been taken by means of infrared ray. By this means, the lens of a camera is able to record in the dark whatever is in existence, as clearly and as precisely as a photograph taken in normal white light. The method adopted has been to flash a powerful Sasha light bulb housed in a light-proof cabinet. One side of the cabinet is fitted with an infrared filter. The bulb generates from 100,000 to 150,000 watts, and the period of the flash, and therefore the exposure, is from 1/50th to 1/75th part of a second. With this momentary flash of such tremendous power, only a very dim, dull red light emission is seen by the eye. The cameras are loaded with plates sensitive to the infrared ray. When the infrared ray first became practical for photographic use in the dark, it was said that it would expose seance room trickery. Through Mr. Weber's mediumship, it has proved the genuineness of physical phenomena, and, by doing so, has provided evidence of survival after death. 24. The infrared ray is most suitable for this work. Firstly, because the radiations emitted are least harmful to ectoplasmic formations, etc. Such formations cannot be physically created in the presence of ultraviolet rays, which are harmful to mediumship, and secondly, because it is the only known process permitting photographic records to be taken in darkness. The rapidity of the exposure prevents the possibility of collusion by any sitter with a medium, for any change of position would be recorded. As a general rule, a number of cameras are positioned in the room in order to obtain photographs from different angles. Any person with a camera possessing a reasonably fast lens can take the photographs. The majority of these photographs have been taken during the sitting of Mr. Weber's developing circle, or at special photographic seances, when representatives of the press and other organizations have been present in their official capacity, bringing with them their own equipment. Occasionally they have been taken in places which the medium has never before visited. Generally the guide, speaking through the medium, gives the instruction when the photograph is to be taken, and the operator in charge of the infrared flash then presses the switch. The camera lenses have meanwhile remained open, awaiting the necessary exposure. On one occasion the press switch to fire the bulb was placed under the medium's hand, so that the guide in control of the medium could press the switch and so take the photograph at the most suitable moment. 25. Chapter 4, The Securing of the Medium. The general method of securing the medium is by a rope, 15 yards long, to a wooden armchair of the Windsor pattern. On occasion the rope has been provided by independent people. Sometimes short lengths are used, with additional independent tapes and threads to secure the arms and legs. The tying up can be carried out by any person present. At the hundreds of public seances, the roping has been carried out by skilleteers, sailors, policemen, and psychic researchers, etc. Further precautions employed are the sewing up of the ends of the rope, after tying, thus making it endless. The ends and knots are sealed with wax and impressed with a seal provided by any sitter. A piece of cotton or wool is then tied at the base of one thumb, a piece of paper threaded on through a needle hole, and the other end tied to the base of the opposite thumb. The value of this precaution in demonstrating supernormal activity is seen when two or three objects are in simultaneous levitation, so wide apart from each other that it would be a physical impossibility for the medium to accomplish the movement normally with hands secured by a cotton or a piece of fragile wool, 15 inches long. The distancing of the objects in levitation can be so wide apart that no one person could manipulate both movements, even with hands quite free. On a number of occasions at the London Spiritual Alliance in 1939, a very long rope, the property of the organization, was used, in which the roping was carried out to plan. A reef knot first secured the center of the rope to the back of the chair. The rope was then passed round the body four times, and each time knotted at the back of the chair. Each upper arm was twice bound and knotted to the back strut of the chair, and the forearms were bound several times to the armrest. The remainder of the rope secured the medium's legs and ankles to the chair legs. The ends of the rope were then sewn together with strong thread, sealed with wax, and impressed with a signet ring. On these occasions, as often happens, the ropes were tied just sufficiently tight so as not to impede blood circulation. During the course of a sitting, about 2 hours, the arms and legs swell, so that by the time the seance ends the ropes are pressing well into the flesh, so much so that the rope marks are visible hours after the termination of the sitting. At the sittings with the London Spiritual Alliance, full demonstrations were given, of which the following two incidents are worthy of mention. Mr. Weber was roped as above, his own rope being left loose near at hand. During the seance this spare rope was taken and the sitter next to the medium was roped by unseen hands to his chair. The rope was taken right across the circle and intertwined in the chair of the sitter opposite, under the seat and round the chair legs, the rope returning to further enmesh the first sitter, the remainder being tied in a confusion of knotting with no end visible. When the seance was over, the rope had to be cut to free the sitter and to free the rope from each chair. The second incident occurred on another occasion, the medium being similarly roped.